Crystal Stokes here with Get Stoked, a podcast with real and raw conversations with leaders of all types, business owners, managers, executives, and more. Get stoked by their honest and insightful stories and key takeaways that you can use to improve your leadership abilities. Now, if you find this podcast helpful, please subscribe and share it with others. Your support and feedback really makes a difference. Now, without further ado, let's dive in. Hey, everybody, Crystal Stokes here, and I'm excited to introduce you all to Charmaine Naraki. She is a partnership manager with a very cool company called AirVet. And today we're going to be talking about a topic that's very, very important and near and dear to me, which is compassion fatigue in the veterinary profession. So Charmaine, if you don't mind, tell us a little bit more about yourself, how you ended up here at this point with AirVet and some of your history.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. So I started out as a young kiddo in the veterinary field. Automatically, I wanted to be, you know, in the vet space. Ever since I was four, I've always said I wanted to be a vet. And so my first job was as a kennel assistant in a one-man show, one doctor, one vet room, just really tiny office. I think I was like 15 or 16 and started off there. And, you know, I explained even, you know, with my first job being there, the doctor there, I explained to him how I want to be a vet. I want to do all these things. How can I get there? What do I do? And it's funny because when I had this conversation with him, he essentially gave me a quality of life conversation. And he said, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to go there? And he just kind of walked me through the whole process of, you know, everything. And he was talking about, you know, your return on investment, your student loans, your time dedicated to this position, what it looks like in the real world. And that kind of knocked me back a few notches. And I was like, well, I don't know if I really want to do that. So I actually ended up, I still stayed with the animal welfare field and veterinary field. I started going on to other hospitals. I worked in an ER and a specialty center for quite a few years. And I've done an internship at a zoo and I stuck with the animal piece, but I started moving more towards the admin side and administration and management. And that led me into being an executive director for an animal shelter, for a nonprofit animal shelter. And that was quite the ride. Oh my goodness. What a side to see in terms of like what we're talking about today as far as compassion fatigue. But that actually led me into coming back to the for-profit side and working with AirVet. And my position now is much more, it's leaning towards shelters and helping get them the resources that they need. AirVet working as the telehealth, telemedicine provider for veterinarians. And I love my position working with shelters, but also working with other partners and businesses and making sure that they have this resource available for themselves and for their clients. So working in the animal welfare field has always been just that huge, you know, love and passion of mine. And but again, you know, working with that doctor, he just kind of sat me down and was like, are you sure you want to do this? it was amazing to have that conversation. Oh,
my cat is here again. I think she comes on about every episode. Hexie says hello. Yeah. Hello.
She's giving hugs.
Yes, she is. So like to summarize some of what you've said is I think that realization of the challenges of working in this profession, whether you become a veterinarian or a technician, you work front desk, you work in management, all of it is very, very challenging. Yes. The veterinary profession may always be challenging. And the question really is around how do we manage these difficulties in ways that still allow us to thrive, feel a sense of purpose and meaning, and that it fits in with the rest of our life? So, you know, when it comes to compassion fatigue, this is kind of a buzzy word. I think that some people might not know what it means. So let's start with just defining compassion fatigue. What is that?
Right. And, you know, thinking about kind of how you listed that with, it doesn't matter what position you hold within veterinary medicine or with animal welfare, you are always going to be working with other people. And I feel that people tend to forget that, right? It's people working with people. And whenever anyone goes into the animal welfare field, the first thing they say is, I don't want to work with people. I want to work with animals, because that's their love. That's their passion.
Yeah.
And they know that those animals, you know, they're not judging them. They're there for help. And we are a nation of givers. So we want to give, 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 and help all these animals and save all these animals. And we forget there's a leash attached to each and every one of those animals, or a carrier, or some other form of a being that is caring for this pet. Mm-hmm. Even strays, you know, you find that you eventually find an owner, or if there's a stray cat community, somebody's taking care of them. They're always usually generally very healthy. And it's, you know, we tend to forget, obviously, that there's that person attached to that animal. And it's difficult for a lot of people to work with other people, especially when you're talking about finances. I mean, you see this, and I'll kind of plug them as well. The Maine Veterinary Hospital, their situation that's happening now. You forget, or tend to forget, that there's that person on the other end of that leash. And although we want to help the animal, if we're going to do that, we have to help the person first, mm-hmm. have that resource available. And when we don't do that, we tend to get this barrier up and have this, we have this compassionate response to this animal, not as much of a compassionate response to the person always. Sometimes though, you see that. And then you do that over and over and over and over again, where you're trying to work with this person, but you can't really do that because they obviously have an expectation in their mind. You have your expectation on this side. And now you're doing this so many times that you're tending to overwork yourself, mm-hmm. to really bring up that social, you know, social piece to this.
Mm-hmm.
And then beyond that, you're working a job where you're working endless hours. I always said this in animal welfare, there are no holidays, there are no weekends. Mm-hmm. You will work every single day of your life. And yeah. as long as you love what you do, that's wonderful. But you still need a break from that, and you still need an outlet. And with that being said, you know, you're working so much, and then the pay is so little in terms of what you're actually monetarily making, because it's never been a very high paying field. Or if you're a veterinarian, for that matter, you're paying off these student loans that are hundreds of thousands of dollars. So you're not actually netting what you think you're going to be netting. And beyond that, it's benefits. And what do those look like? And your family outside of work, your pets outside of work. You still have pets to take care of, right?
Mm.
And then everything else, you know, the whole sphere of it. But honestly, it's such a demanding field. Mm-hmm. And people, again, they tend to forget that. And they're just like, I'm going to save animals.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to save animals.
I have two things I want to plug. One would be, my history with this too, I really resonate so much with the way you describe this. Is growing up, I felt so much more at home with nature and animals, felt kind of odd with people. And I remember, so my initial path was veterinary medicine and also conservation. My bachelor's degree is wildlife conservation. And as I worked in the field doing internships in conservation, I very quickly realized it was not the right field for me, because I was too passionate. I would lose my mind over, mm-hmm. like, what do you mean you don't want to save the sea turtles? I didn't have any way to balance that energy.
Yeah.
And then in the veterinary profession, also having that path myself of learning how important the people are. And now I'm a licensed psychotherapist. So obviously I've bridged the gap, but what helped me bridge that gap was to look at, say, humans are just one more species on the planet, and mm-hmm. they can be just as wonderful and interesting as any other creature, like a cat or a turtle or a horse. That yes. really helped me a lot. But so the other thing I want to bring in is just really, you know, like defining compassion fatigue, the way I would describe it as a psychotherapist and also as a coach would be, giving out so much emotional energy that we become exhausted. So when you're yeah. faced with repeated instances of something that requires compassion, whether it's euthanizing an animal or having a client come in that cannot afford the care and having to make difficult financial decisions. Compassion fatigue can also happen just around the day-to-day of helping manage your team and seeing the stress that they're under and feeling bad that you have to ask your technicians or front desk staff to work extra hours because we're short-staffed. There's so many different ways that we have to flex that muscle of compassion, the muscle mm-hmm. gets very tired. And if we don't have ways of deciding maybe we shouldn't flex it so often, or how do we recover when we've used that muscle a lot, then we get that compassion fatigue. Can you speak at all to what does compassion fatigue look like? Have you experienced it? Have you seen others? Can you tell us a story of what that really feels like? How do people know they have it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you definitely talked about it here briefly with that constant care of others. And whether that's a puppy or a human, you're constantly on go mode, basically. You're constantly in that live mode. And you're never able to just shut down and say, okay, even if you do shut down, it's usually not for the best, right? It's usually at that point where you're just like already ready to explode. And I would say in terms of like what it looks like to me or what I've seen in the industry, it starts off small. It'll be somebody coming in and working extra hours or picking up extra shifts. And I have a great person in my mind for this. She was like the poster child for compassion fatigue. Mm-hmm. When I worked at the shelter, there was this lovely volunteer. And I mean, she was just phenomenal. She would have done anything for these pets. And we were their home, right? Because it's an animal shelter. So they didn't actually have an owner at that point. She would come in, mind you, she had four children of her own at home and her own home life. And she worked. And she would come in the morning for 2 or 3 hours. She would come in the afternoon for 2 or 3 hours, and she'd come back at night. And she would be there as much as she possibly could. And I'm pretty sure if I didn't put a limit on her, she would be there 24 hours out of the day. But we had to put some limits on her. And she would come in all the time. She would just constantly be everywhere, all over the place. There was no organization or structure in her day. She'd just go, 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 go. And it didn't start out like that. She first started volunteering at just 2 hours a day. And she'd walk some dogs, and then she'd go home. And she was very content with that. She was very happy with that. But as we all know, there's people that call out. So there's people that, you know, maybe don't show up for their shift. And then she started filling in for those people. And then she just started taking on more and more and more and more. And it got to the point where then she started trying to manage other people and trying to also micromanage other teams. And it wasn't that she had bad intentions. It was just poor execution. And she would get to this point where she eventually was trying to be there all day long, 12-hour shift every single day. And she was just frantic constantly. And I sat her down one day and I was like, what are you doing? What are you doing here? You need to go home. And she was like, no, I have so much to do, you know, going on and on and on about how much she had to do. And she was just, she had very high energy. She was always very high energy, but she was just absolutely almost manic. And I was just like, no, no more. You cannot do this anymore. And we had to sit her down and talk to her about compassion fatigue. She's like, I know you think that I have that, but I don't, I promise. I was like, that's tells me you do. Mm-hmm. So it's just seeing kind of those small steps eventually build into big steps. And it was this huge explosion for her of just having this breakdown in my office of, you started out wonderful, you're doing great still, you have this great heart and this great intent, but where you're at mentally, you're now not caring for your children or your pets at home. Mm-hmm. You're here all the time. You need to have an outlet that is not this place. And it hurt at first, I think, for her, because she felt defeated. She felt like she wasn't doing her job well, or that she wasn't, you know, doing something right. And it had nothing to do with right or wrong. It just had to do with her self-care and whether or not she was able to care for her things outside of the home too, or excuse me, inside of the home too. Mm. And after that, she started taking some breaks. She started taking weeks off at a time. And I was like, that's fine. Whatever you need to do. Mm. But you being here 24/7 and exploding at other coworkers and trying to, you know, micromanage everything, it's just showing, you know, where you're at in terms of your compassion and how fatigued you are, but you're not seeing.
Mm. That story is such a great example of how it can creep up slowly and easily. And again, this is in many different professions struggle with this. It can be teaching, nursing, definitely in psychotherapy, all the professions where you work with people or creatures that you have to care for. I'm going to read off just some of the like warning signs of compassion fatigue, just so people have some bullet points in their head. I know I'm like a bullet point kind of gal.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I won't read all of them. People can Google this and read more, but just to give you a little taste, some signs that you may be struggling with compassion fatigue would be feelings of helplessness and powerlessness in the face of patient suffering, reduced feelings of empathy and sensitivity. So becoming more apathetic, feeling overwhelmed and exhausted by work demands, feeling detached, numb, and emotionally disconnected, loss of interest in activities that you used to enjoy, increased anxiety, sadness, anger, and irritability, difficulty concentrating and making decisions, sleep difficulty or disturbances, physical health symptoms like nausea, headaches, dizziness, increased conflict in personal relationships, neglecting your own self-care, withdrawal and isolation. So these are all things you can see the person's system is telling them, I need to pull away. I need to reserve some energy. And this often occurs in those of us who feel like we can sense other people's pain and we feel responsible to alleviate that pain. And that is the important little intersection, the awareness that it exists, and then this space between awareness and action. Do we need to react to that and actually do something about it, or is there a better way to manage that situation? So let's move into the part where we've defined compassion fatigue, we've described what it may look like with a great story and given some bullet point items of what it looks like. How about talking a little bit more about specifics in this profession that may contribute to compassion fatigue? So we have we've named a certain personality type, like people that tend to be more empathic. That's one thing that may contribute. What are some other things that are specific to the veterinary profession that may contribute to it, that you may see that happens between the client or the patient or the staff?
Right. And I think we've touched base on a few of them, but yeah, I agree. So there's obviously those overgivers, those people that want to give. And they're very empathetic and they want to care for this animal and they want to, you know, make sure that they're healthy and doing all these things. And then they forget that there's that person there that's attached to this animal. And you ask yourself, or at least I've done this many times in the veterinary profession, why doesn't this owner want to help their animal? Why don't they want to pay for these things to save their animal? And it's not a question of why, it's almost a question of, you know, how can they? Because they maybe don't necessarily have the resources to do so. And so, you know, with that being said, you see this people working with people or trying to work with people. Mm-hmm. And then inside the space of the veterinary welfare field, you have coworkers working with coworkers, and you may have different personalities that kind of butt heads, or they don't see their work ethic as being as strong as theirs. And so they kind of butt heads with them, or they're trying to care for their coworkers. It's the opposite. And they're trying to make sure that they have everything they need to get their job done because they see that this other person may be having a little bit of compassion fatigue. And they're like, well, I'll just pick up their slack because I know that they need help. So I'll do it then. Mm-hmm. And then now they're taking on more. And so it's within that space, then they're getting maybe a little bit resentful and a little bit hurt that they're taking on more for somebody else. And so you have that issue, and then understaffing, because again, people are burnt out, they're going to take a day off, and then everybody else has to pick up the slack because of it. And then you see it in mass movements, right? They see this mass exodus. But then you also have the piece of this financial piece. How are we going to pay our technicians and our assistants and our vets enough to make and retain this top talent? Mm-hmm. Can we do that? And it's so funny. You see the veterinarians that come out of school that have learned about every species on the planet. And it's harder to get into vet school than it is medical school, but they're making 1,000 times less than what a medical doctor would be. And the same with the technicians as, you know, nurses or assistants, they're making far less. And no one ever really pinpoints why, you know, why are they making so much less? And is it you know, is it based on the fact that animals are still viewed as property, or is it, you know, X or Y or Z? And it's really hard to nail that down. But then there's, you know, the benefits piece of why are we not giving these employees resources to really help them in their personal life outside of work? Mm-hmm. So are we giving them resources for employee assistance programs? Are we giving them mental health resources? Are we giving them better pay, better benefits, better unlimited PTO, you know, something to give them time off so that they can recharge that battery that they don't know exists, right? They forget that that battery exists in them. And we all need time away from work. You know, even if you don't want to admit it, you still need a day off, right? To take care of all of the other things out in your outside life.
Right.
So there's so many different factors. There's the people outside your field, outside of the veterinary office. There's people inside the veterinary office. There's your benefits, your pay, your time off. Mm-hmm. There's so many different aspects to this. It's insane.
So I would say to anybody listening, if you're listening to this and you're feeling a little bit overwhelmed by the topic, know that one, you can look at the red flags, the warning signs of compassion fatigue, and just identify fairly easily. Like Google can help with that. You can contact me. I can help with that. First, just identifying, do you meet some of the criteria of having it? If you're listening to this and you're thinking you probably do, you probably do. And you're just, you feel tired, you feel exhausted, you don't want to do it anymore. You're treading water. That whole, the apathy starts to build, a bit of resentment starts to build. Just, you don't see a way off the treadmill. Okay, great. And we're looking at some of the contributing factors. There are so many, we need like 20 podcast episodes to talk about it. It could, again, we touched on some of them today that you may relate to. So the last bit of this podcast, I want to spend a few minutes talking about solutions, which you're already mentioning. So some of the solutions I've already heard you say, what can we do to reduce compassion fatigue? Offering better benefits. So having mental health benefits, wellness benefits, things that can help people balance their non-working hours. Was one thing that you mentioned. Say some more. Oh, you also mentioned adequate pay, how stressful it is when you're not making adequate pay. So keep going. Give us some more ideas of ways that we could reduce compassion fatigue.
One thing that sticks out in my mind that we've talked about before is the leadership practice. And a lot of leaders, you know, and I think I speak from experience for this myself, you come into this field because you want to save animals, and then you start moving up the chain a little bit, and you see, you know, this management piece is being able to impact, have a huge impact in your field in some way. But you forget that a leader, you're being called to serve at that point, right? You're called to serve your people of your organization. And a lot of leaders get into this thinking that they're going to lead a team, but you're really needing to create more leaders. You need to create more leaders in your field, not just followers, not people that are just going to blindly do what you say, because we don't want that. We want people that are going to lead their teams and then lead individuals as well. And I think for the leadership practices, that leadership training should not just be for your leaders. It should be for the rest of your company, like all of your team. Absolutely. They need that.
I just want, if I could hug you through the camera, I would. So what has been so phenomenal for me, and it may be that I'm somewhat of a bubble, but here in Santa Barbara, it is a more affluent area, but the veterinary hospitals here are struggling with the same issues of, you know, we can't find staffing. There's, you know, so many clients need to be seen. You know, the financial piece is always really hard. There's the same pain points. But I've seen a movement here. We had, two veterinarian suicides about maybe 5 years ago or so. And that woke up our community. And so there's been a welcoming of services like what I provide. I provide leadership and cultural development services. And my whole orientation is that everybody's a leader. Leadership means you support others in their development. That is one of the core components of leadership and helping others be their best and have autonomy and agency. So mastery of delegation and of knowing boundaries. And when I have somebody come to me that maybe is experiencing compassion fatigue, one is I always treat it as a unique case. We all experience it differently. So I like to start with the person's, you know, who are you as a unique individual? Right? How do you operate? What are the things that are causing you pain? What are your unique pain points? Then we start looking at that list of what can you stop doing? What do you need to do better? You know, what can you improve? And so it's this fine, a very personalized process of deciding for you as an individual, as a leader, or as somebody who's an emerging leader, how can you go about changing your the way you're operating in your world to really help you thrive, to get off the treadmill, step back from it and say, something needs to change here. And often it does have to do with boundaries, knowing when to say no and when to say yes. Improving delegation skills, knowing what to hand off versus what to keep, and then how to really support others in whatever you've delegated to them. Like if you can really develop people around you and trust them when you hand something off, that it'll be done well, that they can come to you for support if needed. That can be so relieving, because I think of another factor that we kind of addressed not directly is compassion fatigue developing because we feel like we have to do it all ourselves.
Yes. That trust piece right there is the biggest piece. Because you see it every day in veterinary practices where many people don't trust their coworkers to do the job the way they would do it. Mm-hmm. And you see this huge enamel out there, especially shelters, where I'm just going to do all these things myself because I don't trust the next person to get the job done right. Mm-hmm. Well, eventually you will burn out. You will. It's inevitable. So developing those people to know what to do, when to do, and then having those boundaries to say, yes, I can do this, or no, I can't do that. Can you help me do this? Mm-hmm. And asking for help, knowing when to ask for help and what to ask for help on, because I feel like that's another huge piece too, is you may be able to ask for help, but do you know what you're asking? Do you know what you're asking for and how to obtain that? And it's that trust piece is huge. Absolutely huge.
It's so lovely you're bringing this in. And we'll probably wrap up on this note and do a little summary because I'm watching the clock and this is a very, very meaty topic, I'm noticing. on the trust side, I think if I were listening to this, let's say I'm extremely busy. I don't really feel like I have time to train people. And I think if I hand this off, they're going to mess it up. I just know it. And I'd say, you know what? You're probably right. But that's where we have to think about short-term versus long-term. If we would just say, hey, look, in the short term, it might take more time than I'd like it to take up front to really truly educate and support and train a few more people. Yeah, it's going to take your time. You're not going to be as efficient while you're doing that. But when you train somebody, this is what I love to develop in leaders is how do you effectively lead a team? It's not common sense. We are not born knowing this. We did not learn it in school with our ABCs. So people that have gone through their veterinary training, medical training or technician training or whatever it may be, they weren't trained to run a business or to develop leadership capacities. So why don't we go and receive that training, learn how to do these things? And then you can feel like I can do this in a more efficient way. I feel confident in my ability to train people. And now when I hand things off, my trust level is much higher. And even if my trust is broken, I know how to repair it. I know how to have a meaningful conversation with that individual because nobody wants to screw it up on purpose. They're trying their best too, 99% of the time. So what went wrong? How can we diagnose that and fix that? So,
exactly. Yep. That's a huge piece to it.
Well, so much of what you've said today to bring it all tie it into a nice little bow is it's about the people. People at the end of the day working with other people. Yes, we're here to save animals and to care for animals, but we must remember that we are constantly in relationship with other people, whether it's the pet parent or the staff that we work with. Those factors are critically important, and that can be a big contributing factor to compassion fatigue or whether or not you have it.
Absolutely.
What do you want to say kind of in summary just of that topic before I ask you a few rapid fire questions?
Oh, say that one more time. Sorry.
Is there anything you'd want to say in summary, to wrap this segment up about compassion fatigue before I go into some rapid fire questions?
Yeah. I think people tend to not look at those bullet points like you were saying and really identifying whether or not they identify with those. And if you even think you do, you do. You should absolutely try and look at that and make sure that you're getting all the pieces taken care of. Take care of you first, your oxygen mask first. They always tell you that, right? Mm-hmm. And then you will thrive because survival is not a mode of life. You should absolutely thrive.
I hear you. Life is too short to spend suffering. We are meant to spend our work should be meaningful and fulfilling. Yes, it can be hard, but it should not be diminishing our life force energy and having us moving towards depression or burnout.
Exactly.
And I'll say to people too, if you really are feeling that stuck feeling, like you listen to this and you think, I hear everything you're saying, but I still feel like I'm not going to get out of it. I hear these tips and tricks, or I can read about it online, but I can't go from the knowledge to the action. Like, changing the behavior is so hard to actually stop giving, or to say no can feel impossible. And I'd say that's where reaching out to professionals that can work with like behavioral psychology, that's the key, because we all have our unique way of rationalizing this behavior that's hurting us. And a person who works with behavioral psychology, their job is to help unwind those behaviors and teach behaviors that are healthier, that make you feel better, that help you thrive. So if you're feeling stuck, just know there is help. Just like what you were saying, Charmaine, hopefully you have a company that supports your benefits, that helps you connect with people that help with your health and wellness, and like, use those resources. We're not meant to do this alone. We're not supposed to just magically snap our fingers and know how to do this. It takes effort to learn new behavioral patterns.
New behavioral patterns and new practices within the field, right? So I'll use Ayurveda as an example. This telehealth, telemedicine movement is going to be a way for veterinary professionals to really cut down on their time seeing clients in person. And it also helps that fear-free kind of practice where you're having the pet seen in the home so they don't have to come in. So, and then beyond that, you're looking at your employees that don't have to take time off work to have their pet seen. They could, or even if they're at home, they don't have to bring the pet in. They could just do it virtually. So you're looking at that practice of how can we create more efficient ways to make sure that these pets are taken care of, but also that our people are taken care of and our pet parents are taken care of. So beyond that, it's like a whole scope of things. It's not going to be just one person, right? It's going to be a whole movement within this veterinary field. And it has to be if you're going to make change with it. But exactly like you touched on, it starts with one person and you have to start with your behaviors and your habits, because if you don't, you're just going to end up doing the same cycle over and over and over.
Well said. I love this. Now tell me, if you could go back in time and talk to your younger self, do you have any one piece of advice you might want to give her with everything you know now?
Oh gosh, one piece of advice?
That's pick the juiciest one.
Oh my goodness. If I could go back and tell myself anything, I would just say, look at your heart first. The rest will come later.
Beautiful. And now I'll also mention, I know that you have a very young child at home.
Yes.
Do you have any special like routines or habits on a daily, weekly, monthly basis that really help keep you at your best? And you're juggling all of this, you know, being a mom, being involved in this organization, like living a full life. How do you stay at your best?
Oh gosh, it's a challenge, but I would say the easiest thing that's been for me that really fills my cup is playing with my kids. I will admit first, I did not view myself as a mother. And now that I am, it was so hard for me to just play, just to stop and play, because I have 10,000 other things to do and it is not playing. So I have to really consciously make an effort to play with my kids. But then when I do, I feel 10,000 times better. I immediately feel great. And like, I feel like I've done something for you. You've done something for me. We are just like this perfect little family unit. And if I don't do that, I feel chaotic and my brain's a mess and my kids are a mess and everything's crazy. So I actually, connecting with my kids is the biggest thing for me.
Oh, I love that. That is so sweet. And the element of play, it's so underrated. It helps our nervous system regulate. It helps just to shift gears from a psychological standpoint. One of my favorite parts of the day is I have recently adopted a big tomcat. He's neutered now. And he's just a big ball of like energetic muscle. He's orange. You can just picture this orange cat. And his favorite thing is right at bedtime when I get in the bed, he wants to play. Like, he is full of energy and he's so rambunctious. And again, like just like a tiger. And I think it's so fun. I look forward to every evening. I look forward to getting into bed and having playtime with my fur baby. Play cannot, it's as adults, cute. We often don't have time. We think we don't have time to play. We don't prioritize it, but it can really make life so much better to bring that in. I've never had anybody say that before. That's a really fun one for people to consider, adding more play into their day.
Yes. Prioritize play. It's the best thing.
So Charmaine, for people listening today, if they want to reach out to you and connect, they have more questions about compassion fatigue or your journey or AirVet, what's the best way for them to find you?
Yeah, so connect with me on LinkedIn. That's the easiest way to find me. And just, you know, I'm sure you'll put the link in there. But yeah, connecting on LinkedIn is usually the easiest.
Okay, great. So I will post that in the show notes so we can find it. And Charmaine, I really appreciate your time today. This has been, it's a very important topic. And I just love all of your insights and the personal stories that you've brought to it as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Definitely. Thank you for joining me today. I hope that you feel stoked after listening to this episode. And as always, I would love to hear your comments and feedback. Is there a topic that you want to know more about? Please let me know. And thank you again for subscribing and sharing your favorite episodes with others. It really means a lot.